From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President-elect Donald Trump's transition team announced two more cabinet appointments this morning. Steven Mnuchin for Treasury Secretary and Wilbur Ross for Secretary of Commerce. Here's Ross this morning on CNBC talking about trade deals.
Believe it or not, Mexico has better treaties with the rest of the world than the United States does. We're going to fix that.
Joining us now is NPR business correspondent John Idsty. Hi, John.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's start with Steven Mnuchin, who was Trump's campaign finance chairman and started that job at a time when the organization barely had any fundraising structure. Here he is on CNBC today as well.
Our most important priority is sustained economic growth. And I think we can absolutely get to sustained 3-4% GDP. And that is absolutely critical for the country.
And worth pointing out that at last check, I think yesterday, the economy already growing at 3.2% right now. But tell us more about Steven Mnuchin.
Yeah, Steven Mnuchin may inherit an economy that's already breaking out. Mnuchin is 53 years old. He spent most of his professional life on Wall Street. He was at Goldman Sachs for 17 years, ultimately as a partner. Worked for a time for George Soros, the big Democratic contributor. He now runs a privately owned hedge fund, Dune Capital Management. He went to a Trump victory party last spring and met Trump there and was almost immediately offered a job as finance chairman. And he obviously did pretty well at that. He's previously donated to both Republicans and Democrats. He helped Trump get his tax proposal together with massive tax cuts that would cost the government between $3 and $6 trillion over 10 years. But he has no real government policy experience. He knows Wall Street well and financial markets well. And depending on your point of view, that would make him perfect as Treasury Secretary. Or some other folks would say that's the worst kind of choice for someone who should be a watchdog on Wall Street. He's also, interestingly, a financier of movies like Avatar, Suicide Squad, more recently released in August, many others. So he spent a lot of time on the West Coast recently.
What about Trump's other pick for Commerce Secretary, Wilbur Ross, somebody else who has some Wall Street ties? Tell us about him and how he might influence policy.
Well, Wilbur Ross is a billionaire investor, and he's a real turnaround specialist. Over the past 15 years, he has purchased bankrupt companies and rehabilitated them, often turning a profit by selling them overseas. And in making his fortune, he really did rely at times on methods that Mr. Trump promised to crack down on, like building factories overseas. One interesting thing, he's often criticized American management. He's talked to Morning Edition often, and he told Steve Inskeep once that many industries in decline, you know, have managements who think of themselves as losers and want to blame others. It'll be the fault of the unions or the fault of China or the fault of government. So they, you know, they're not really doing their job. And he sees himself as going into companies and actually doing the job and trying to save companies. The problem is, as he saves them, he shrinks them, and that often costs jobs. On the other hand, he saves jobs that might have otherwise been lost. And, you know, there are even union people who credit him with saving jobs.
John, both of these guys have ties to Wall Street. A lot of people are critical of that already, that Trump's team doesn't look like a team coming from, you know, the industrial Midwest who's going to stand up for the working class. Are either of these guys likely to face trouble in their confirmation hearings?
Well, you know, I think unlikely for Ross. I think Mnuchin's a different story. You know, he's a creature of Wall Street, and Trump criticized Wall Street through the campaign. But even more of a problem for him, I think, is this his involvement with a bank, IndyMac. He purchases during the midst of the financial crisis, along with some billionaire investors. They renamed it One West, and critics have called it a foreclosure machine. The bank actually foreclosed on something like 36,000 homeowners over the past 7 years or so. They sold it at a profit. And so I think that may complicate his confirmation, although I have to say I think both of these guys are likely to be confirmed.
That's NPR business correspondent John Idsty. John, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Jeremy.
Well, the UN says thousands of people have been displaced by the recent ferocious fighting over Aleppo as Syrian government forces push into this long rebel-held city. Leaflets dropped by planes read, "If you don't leave these areas quickly, you will be annihilated." And the Syrian forces have been able to claw back parts of the city that the rebels have controlled for 4 years. The BBC's chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, is watching all of this from Damascus. And Lise, I know you're trying to get into Aleppo, but we're hearing reports that Aleppo might soon fall to Assad's forces.
I think it's very difficult to say with any certainty exactly when all of Aleppo would be recaptured by Syrian government forces backed by their Iranian and Russian allies. What we do know is that in recent days, they have achieved a stunning advance, taking more than 40% of the rebel-held eastern enclave back from the rebel-held forces. We understand that the opposition groups, and there are many groups, including groups linked to al-Qaeda, they've headed south now, where they're focusing on a new front line. The government is vowing to retake all of Aleppo back, and some officials admit they'd like to take it back by the end of January before a new president takes over in the White House.
And why? Is there an urgency to take it over before President-elect Donald Trump takes office?
There has been talk for many weeks now that the Syrian forces, believing that the Americans are distracted by the window in between the end of President Obama's administration and the beginning of President Trump's, that they want to present a fait accompli when the new administration takes charge. And of course, they were surprised, like many people, that it wasn't going to be a Hillary Clinton administration, but a Donald Trump administration. And they hope that a president-elect who's talking already about working with Russia and Syria's President Bashar al-Assad to fight against so-called Islamic State will be a country that they can establish a better working relationship with.
Well, of course, this is chilling for the rebels who've been fighting the civil war for years. What does this mean now that Syrian forces have had such success in the last few days in Aleppo? What does that mean for the broader picture?
If Aleppo falls, it will be a huge strategic and moral blow to the opposition. It's one of the areas where you still have some of the opposition groups backed by the West still fighting, although they are by no means the dominant force in East Aleppo. So it would mark a turning point in the war, but certainly not the end of the war.
Yeah. Well, no matter what happens here, there is a humanitarian crisis. It seems to have swelled in the last few days with people fleeing Aleppo. Some areas still in East Aleppo haven't had food aid in months. Give us your thumbnail of what's going on the humanitarian side.
People have been suffering for months upon months in eastern Aleppo. The UN says it hasn't been able to reach people in that area since July. We spoke to the International Committee of the Red Cross a short time ago. They haven't been able to reach people for the past 7 months. Food and medicine are scarce. The United Nations has been trying to get agreement from all the sides. They still don't have it from the Syrian government to be able to bring in convoys. They have an understanding from some of the armed opposition groups that the food will be allowed to go in. The Russians had said they would be interested in facilitating it. But now that we've had this upsurge in fighting, it seems quite unlikely that there will be a convoy of badly needed food aid anytime soon. And a new dimension has been added because tens of thousands of people are on the run, fleeing for their lives, carrying whatever they can. And they're trying to find assistance, many in the government-held side of Aleppo in the West, where there are some aid agencies there able to help them. But the ICRC told us here that the situation is absolutely devastating. There aren't enough resources to help them. There aren't enough shelters. And of course, winter is closing in. It's very cold today in Syria, and the temperatures will continue to drop. So the humanitarian crisis just keeps taking shape and deepening. And the real concern now is that as fighting concentrates on the last remaining areas of the rebel-held territory in the east, that people won't be able to flee. They'll be trapped, and food and medicine will not be able to get in. So you'll have a very, very dark chapter, which will continue to unfold.
The BBC's chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, watching the situation in Syria from Damascus. And Lise, trying to get into Aleppo, we understand. Really? As it falls? I mean, what is your sense? Western Aleppo is still largely government-controlled, but what is your sense that you'll be able to get in there?
The road from Damascus to northern Syria to the city of Aleppo is clear now. There are obviously risks. This is a country at war, but you can move north to Aleppo. The west is under government control, so we can access it. The west does come under fire as well from rockets and mortars fired by the opposition. Of course, the opposition doesn't have the kind of firepower to be able to carry out the devastating strikes that we're seeing happening in the east of Aleppo, but they still have the ability to cause damage and also cause casualties and destruction.
Well, best of luck to you. Lise, thanks as always.
Thank you.
The recounts that Green Party candidate Jill Stein is pursuing in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania haven't started yet, but she's already running into roadblocks. In Wisconsin, where Trump won by 22,000 votes, a judge refused to require county officials to recount ballots from the presidential election by hand, leaving it up to the counties to decide how to recount the ballots. In Michigan, where Trump won by about 10,000 votes, the recount could begin later this week. And in Pennsylvania, a court will hear Stein's request for a recount next week. Dave Davies is a senior reporter for WHYY in Philadelphia, part of the Here and Now Contributors Network. He joins us now. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Jeremy.
And Donald Trump won Pennsylvania by more than 70,000 votes. Not close. Is there a feeling that a recount could change the results?
I think most think it's pretty unlikely. You know, the state calls for a recount in a margin of 0.5% or less. Trump's margin is more than 1%. So I think the common wisdom is that unless something really surprising like Russian hacking is discovered, this result will stand.
In order to get the recount in Pennsylvania, petitions are needed with voters in all the districts. Stein put out a video on Facebook over the weekend asking for voters' help. Here she is.
We can come together to say we need a voting system that we all can rely on. So I want to, you know, lay to rest. We're not on anybody's side here. We're not trying to hurt one candidate or help another candidate. This is about helping us restore confidence in our democracy.
So what's the process here? It sounds like you have to provide quite a bit to get a recount going in Pennsylvania.
Well, right. Absent a statewide recount, which doesn't happen because the margin doesn't justify, there is this provision that says there will be a recount in any precinct in which three voters sign a petition and ask for it. And the Stein campaign managed to get hundreds of people to do this over the weekend. So what we're going to find this week is a bunch of baby recounts, if you will, happening in a small fraction of the state's voting precincts. Stein's lawyers hope that that will show some discrepancies which will support its other legal initiative, which is a statewide formal contest of the result. This has never happened in Pennsylvania, but Stein's lawyers have indeed filed such a challenge. It relies, by the way, on the notion that there was cyber hacking that altered the results in Pennsylvania.
And what are people in Pennsylvania saying about this recount?
Most aren't paying that much attention. Smart election lawyers think it's a real long shot. But what's interesting about this, Jeremy, is that the argument for a challenge is based on a affidavit by a University of Michigan computer scientist named Alex Halderman. And in it, he offers an argument on how a very sophisticated hacker might alter voting machines so they steal just enough votes so as to make a difference, but not so many as to be obvious, then erase themselves. And it's the kind of thing that we would have all thought was crazy 5 years ago after some of the stuff we've seen about the DNC hacking and the penetration of voter registration systems in a couple of states. You think, maybe. The problem is that election courts tend to want evidence, and there's simply none offered that any of this happened. So I think it's considered a long shot.
And the Commonwealth Court in Pennsylvania has said it wants to have this whole process wrapped up by December 13th. What happens next?
There will be a hearing on Monday to hear this. Most people think that the judge will issue a quick decision. It will probably be reviewed by the state Supreme Court. And as you said, they want to find out by December 13th because that's when the winning candidate's electors have to be told to report to cast their votes in the Electoral College.
We'll keep watching in Pennsylvania and in Michigan and Wisconsin. Dave Davies, senior reporter at WHYY in Philadelphia. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Jeremy.
Well, yesterday we brought you a story from Oakland, California, about two moms, one black, one white, deciding where to send their kids to school. Like in many big cities, the public schools in Oakland are largely segregated by race and class. And critics say the district's enrollment policy is part of the problem. Zadie Stavely from Here and Now contributor KQED brings us the second part of our series.
Marina Munoz is walking her daughter to school in East Oakland. They pass an old mattress lying on the curb, then some abandoned cars. They cross an empty lot littered with piles of old clothes and smelly trash. To Munoz, the picture is clear.
Here in East Oakland, we are all poor. Poor in everything, including education.
Munoz's kids go to elementary and high school at Madison Park Academy. It's almost entirely Latino and African American. Nearly all of the kids qualify for free and reduced lunch. The principal there has made a lot of improvements in recent years, with wraparound services for kids and families. Still, Madison Park Academy has larger than average class sizes and low test scores compared to the top tier schools in the district. And that bothers Munoz. She's convinced her kids are not getting as good an education as kids in the wealthy Oakland Hills. One of her most frustrating moments was last year. Her son was a junior in high school, an important year for kids trying to prepare for college, and he had a sub for months.
Pues decía mi hijo, ni nos enseña nada.
He would call and say, Mom, come get me. I'm not doing anything. So how are we going to send our kids to college if we don't have well-trained teachers?
Munoz never considered sending her children to one of the top-performing schools in the Oakland Hills. When she first moved here from Mexico, it took her 2 months to figure out how to enroll her kids, let alone send them to a school outside her neighborhood.
I didn't have a car, and it was just too hard to walk far or pay for the bus. We wouldn't have enough money for food.
Transportation is a serious issue in this district. Oakland Unified doesn't offer free travel to get to a school outside your neighborhood. But even if Munoz could get to a Hills school, many of those schools wouldn't have space for her kids because they fill up with kids from their own neighborhoods, who get priority. Neighborhoods that are mostly white and wealthy.
I feel very strongly that there needs to be a conversation and a system put into place to desegregate the schools.
Tanya Harris used to teach at one of the top performing schools in the district, Crocker Highlands Elementary. While Black families have moved in and out of the neighborhood over the years, today it's a wealthy neighborhood that's mostly white. And there's a historical context for this. This community was one of the first in the state to have racial covenants that kept African Americans out of the neighborhood. The federal government outlawed covenants in 1968. This Oakland neighborhood didn't officially lift them until 1979. After teaching at Crocker for 5 years, Harris began working at schools in high poverty neighborhoods, like where Marina Munoz lives.
And then I would drive down that hill and, you know, past those beautiful, huge homes and tree-lined streets. And I would get on the freeway and then I would get off. I brought tears to my eyes and I thought, it's like I live in a third world country.
Harris says when you have such stark inequity in neighborhoods and most children go to their neighborhood school, you're creating a two-tiered system of access.
Access to everything. Access to health care. Access to, obviously, jobs. To grocery stores. Access to the educational experience that kids and families deserve in order to interrupt these continuous cycles of poverty.
Back in 2003, when Harris first started teaching at Crocker Highlands, she says there was space for kids from outside the neighborhood. At that time, she says many white families living in the neighborhood were sending their kids to private school. So Crocker Highlands was more evenly divided between African-American kids, many from other parts of Oakland, and neighborhood kids.
My first PTA meeting, I'll never forget it. The PTA members were talking about how important diversity was. And then several years into my experience there, that narrative shifted significantly.
What happened is Crocker Highland families started working to get more of their neighbors to send their kids to Crocker, to invest in the neighborhood school and improve it.
There was an active group that was working with the local realtor who was really intentional about, you know, selling homes to people who are going to be committed to sending their kids to Crocker.
Over time, more and more African-American kids from outside of the neighborhood were simply squeezed out. Today, 60% of Crocker Highlands students are white. 10% are Black. Only a handful qualify for free and reduced lunch. The irony here is that white kids in Oakland get to go to school with kids not like them. Many kids of color in Oakland rarely have that chance.
Our schools really reflect what is a housing segregation issue.
Janelle Scott is an associate professor of education at UC Berkeley and an Oakland parent.
Our embracing of neighborhood schools without any kind of affirmative plan to interrupt neighborhood racial segregation patterns means that our schools are largely going to look like our neighborhoods look, and our neighborhoods are quite segregated.
What if we were to say we will never allow school to have more than 80% free and reduced price lunch or less than 60%? I don't know what that buffer zone is.
Oakland Unified's enrollment director is Charles Wilson. He says the district plans to apply for a federal grant to try to integrate the schools socioeconomically, maybe offering spaces at high-performing schools to kids from low-income neighborhoods.
It is a priority. It is also a very thorny issue that's going to require a lot of delicate movement and include the community in.
School integration plans are often met with lawsuits and white and wealthy parents fleeing to private school. Hard as it may be, Janelle Scott says integration has to happen.
For me, it comes back to, well, what kind of society do we want to have? Do we want our children as young adults to be able to get along with each other, to know about each other, to be respectful of each other?
Oakland's diversity, she says, is an incredible opportunity for people to really understand each other across lines of race and class. Schools that are integrated are one of the rare places where that understanding can begin. For Here and Now, I'm Zadie Stavely.
Around 50 million Americans have allergies to pollen, drugs, food. Yet despite that number, there have been very few advances in allergy treatments. Well, now scientists are getting closer to understanding the root causes of allergies, and they're working on treatments more customized to each sufferer and treatments that can stop allergies rather than just treat symptoms. Megan Akeshavan covers biotech for STAT, the health and medicine publication, and our weekly partners. She joins us from Culver City, California. Hi, Megan.
Hi.
And so why so few advances in allergy treatments?
Well, the most basic reason is that we have antihistamines and we have Benadryl and steroids, and we have this whole class of drugs that do work fairly well with allergies, and they're cheap and they're easy to get, but they are not effective for everybody. For instance, I have terrible allergies. They don't necessarily help me.
Right, right. Well, now Sean Parker, who made his millions with the now defunct Napster, he donated $24 million to Stanford University to set up an allergy center. Nestle's invested $145 million in a startup focused on peanut allergies. Why now?
Well, I think that as more and more people are getting awareness about allergies, people are realizing that there's a need for these drugs. And as far as food allergies go, there are absolutely no FDA-approved treatments at all. So there's just a hole that the pharmaceutical industry is now noticing.
Right. What could be a very lucrative one. One of the more promising experimental treatments out there is the Nestle-backed startup Aimmune, a peanut desensitization pill. How does that work?
It's actually quite basic. They have isolated the proteins from a peanut that cause allergies, and they just give you incrementally larger amounts of those proteins over time. So basically, you build your way up over several months to eat the equivalent of a single peanut.
Well, this is one of the problems, you tell us, with allergy research, because it is somewhat dangerous in human trials. You're asking people to take something that they are allergic to, so there are fears of liabilities. But in the case of this pill, does it work? Is there evidence that it does?
Yeah, I mean, people are showing that these types of desensitizations work in all kinds of allergens. I mean, they do things similarly with allergy shots where you get small amounts of pollen injected into your system and things mm-hmm. like, or, you know, equivalents to pollen.
It's also what people tell parents, for instance, to do with children, to make sure that they eat a number of things so they have built up some sort of immunity to them. It seems kind of simple, you know, but you call it a trailblazer in allergy science. Why?
Because no one's really doing it for food allergies, except for, I mean, there are a group of allergists out there that are doing it on their own. They are creating incremental amounts of, you know, allergens, and they're feeding it to their patients. And, you know, it does seem to work, but no one is doing it in the drug industry in a clinically tested manner. So, you know, it's just doing something that other people haven't really thought of.
Right. There's also a Japanese company working on a DNA vaccine for people allergic to cedar pollen. Apparently a huge problem in Japan, huge allergies there. How would that work?
It's a little complicated, but basically they attach some genetic material that codes for the proteins that cause the allergies for, say, cedar pollen. And they get this vaccine so that it burrows into your immune cells and it helps your body ward away an allergic attack without even being exposed to the allergen. So it's supposed to hypothetically be a safer route to treating an allergy before it even starts.
That's Meghana Keshavan, who covers biotech for STAT. We'll post her article at herenow.org. Meghana, thank you.
Thank you.
Today, President-elect Donald Trump announced his intention to nominate Steven Mnuchin to be Secretary of the Treasury and Wilbur Ross to be Secretary of Commerce. Both have a background on Wall Street. And Trump has said he wants to dismantle the Dodd-Frank Wall Street reforms put in place after the financial crisis. Joining us now is someone who was at the table making decisions for the country before, during, and after the crisis, Sheila Bair, who is a Republican and was chair of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or FDIC, from 2006 to 2011. She's currently president of Washington College in Chestertown, Maryland. Sheila Bair, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And as one of the people who was at the center of the financial crisis and the aftermath, what have you been thinking about since the election of Donald Trump?
Well, anticipation. I understand he thinks we have overregulated. And so I would not disagree that some of the financial regulations we put in place since the crisis have been overly complex and perhaps of incremental value. But I think others have been very, very important. So I hope he will pursue a policy of smart regulation, not no regulation, because no regulation was the what got us into trouble in the first place in 2008.
Well, his team has promised to dismantle the 2010 Dodd-Frank financial reform bill, saying that it's made big banks more of a threat to the economy and to working families. Do you think it would be easy to do that, to just take away the whole thing?
Yeah. Well, certainly Dodd-Frank was a pretty much a big grant of authority to regulators to implement it. So, yes, you can do a lot of undoing of Dodd-Frank by just putting new people into the federal regulatory agencies who could have the authority to undo some of these rules, water them down, or just not enforce them.
Well, what would be the three things in Dodd-Frank that you would say, if he is going to start to dismantle it, he should try to keep those things because they're important?
Well, capital, first, second, and third probably, is a capital. I really think the root cause of the problem prior to the crisis was these large financial institutions were just relying too much on borrowed money. You know, we talk about homeowners borrowing too much on their mortgages, but large financial institutions were overwhelmingly funding their operations with borrowed money, very little common equity. So when the housing market turned, when they started experiencing losses, they immediately became insolvent. There was no cushion. So, and this also incentivized risk-taking because they were gambling with other people's money. Shareholders did not have enough of their own skin in the game. So increasing the amount of shareholder equity that large institutions must have to fund their operations, I think, and their risk-taking, I think, is extremely important. And I hope he keeps that. I think also baseline consumer protections are very important. Again, we didn't have mortgage lending standards. We do now. I hope they don't throw the baby out with the bathwater at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. I think there have been a lot of, I don't agree with everything the CFPB's done, but I think on mortgage lending standards, they've done good work, and I hope that wouldn't get out of return.
Do you think the CFPB should stay?
I do. I've always supported the CFPB. I think they're structurally, and I think they should be independently funded. I don't think they should be funded through the appropriations process. But I do in terms of a being governed by a commission or board as opposed to an individual director. I think that has merit. And actually, this situation kind of highlights, I think, why that's important because, again, Mr. Trump, I don't know where he's going to be on consumer protection, but if he wanted to really dismantle the CFPB, he could do that just by appointing his own director because it's just a single person that can pretty much do whatever they want. If you had a commission, a bipartisan commission, there would be less risk, I think, that so much could be undone by just one person. So I actually have always supported a commissioner board structure for the CFPB. And finally, I think some of the rules we have against risk-taking, I know there's been talk about undoing the Volcker Rule, but I actually think the Volcker Rule, large banks that are engaged in trading activities have accepted that. They put the compliance systems in place. I think they support it now. So I don't know what would be accomplished by undoing the Volcker Rule at this point.
And the Volcker Rule, for people who don't know, is the rule that bans big banks from gambling with their own money, basically.
Right, exactly.
You were one of the people who famously saw the future, basically, and saw that there was trouble in the subprime mortgage market back before the collapse. What do you see now? What are the worries that you have that President-elect Trump's going to have to deal with?
Right. Well, again, I don't think he wants to loosen mortgage lending standards. Mortgages are by far the largest financial commitment most families will ever make, and there need to be some basic standards on affordability. They shouldn't be getting mortgages they can't afford to repay. And so I do hope that he keeps those in place. Interest rates going up, actually, that could temper mortgage lending. So the impact that might have on housing has yet to be seen. Though I would say that, even at the slightly higher rates now, we still have very, very low mortgage rates compared to what has been the historical norm. There are other parts of the economy, though. I think in commercial real estate, I think the stock and bond market is arguably overvalued. There are areas where, I think we need to be very careful. And we found out, again, during the crisis, there's a difference between free markets and free-for-all markets. We need some baseline regulation of financial services. I do think we have asset bubbles in particular sectors that could be made worse if banks, again, are allowed to take highly leveraged speculative bets in these various asset classes. That could be dangerous, and I hope Mr. Trump doesn't go down that path.
What are you talking about specifically, sectors?
Well, I think commercial real estate is probably in some sectors is we're getting overbuilt. I think there is leveraged lending. I know the regulators have tried to tamp that down a bit. That's another area where I think you could see some speculative froth. I think derivatives are always a problem. We've never really, even with Dodd-Frank, I don't think we've dealt very effectively with derivatives as a way to take highly leveraged speculative bets. And so those are the areas I would be focusing on in particular, especially, in a volatile interest rate environment, how interest rate derivatives are going to perform. There are a whole host of risks associated with this very prolonged period of very low interest rates that has created what I believe are financial asset bubbles, as well as incentives to take risk because borrowing rates are so low. So I do think he needs to be cognizant of the continued fragility of the financial system and be very thoughtful before he tries to loosen up on any of the financial regulations that we've put in place so far.
You haven't mentioned student loan debt, which I know is something that you've been talking about a lot, and you mentioned in a letter that you wrote to the president-elect.
You know, I did. I think, yes, I am very, very, excessive borrowing, whether it's mortgages, student debt, it is never good for the individual consumer, nor is it good for the economy. And we've had a lot of unaffordable student borrowing, a lot of student borrowers now in trouble with their loans. It is a drag on the economy. All those debt payments that students have to make when they graduate, that's money they're not spending on cars or houses or starting businesses. And so there is ample research that shows this is hurting the economy as well as hurting individual student borrowers. I like the idea of what's called income share agreements, where you actually scrap a debt model and have a repayment based on some percentage of a student borrower's actual pay over some period of years. That kind of ensures that everybody's got an affordable payment, and you let them pay off over a longer period of time, so that your recoveries are roughly equivalent, so taxpayers don't take losses. But by having lower payments over a longer period of time, that's actually based on what the borrower earns after graduation, not some rigid amortization schedule, that you keep borrowers out of distress and minimize defaults. So he actually, in a speech in Columbus, Ohio, had alluded to this concept, and I hope it's something he pursues, because I do think that could be of tremendous benefit to student borrowers, and it would be a nice gesture of goodwill to young people. A lot of them are afraid of him, as some of the heated rhetoric. They're afraid of his attitudes towards students of color and other vulnerable groups. And so I think the more he can reach out and assure people he's a president for all Americans, he's sensitive to the economic challenges all Americans face, and moving on student debt, which disproportionately impacts students of color, I think that would be a tremendous goodwill gesture, and one that could also help our economy, consistent with his desire to revitalize our economy, to make America great again, as was in his campaign promises. I think student debt would be a great place to start.
That's Sheila Bair, the former chair of the FDIC and now president of Washington College in Chestertown, Maryland. Sheila Bair, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
blizzard conditions have not put off protesters in the standoff at the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota. Neither has an evacuation order from the governor, a sheriff's vow to block access, rubber bullets, tear gas, and water cannons used by security forces. The protests began last spring to stop construction of the Dakota Access Oil Pipeline, which protesters say will cross sacred lands and damage water sources. The Army Corps of Engineers did put a temporary stay on building it, but the company, Energy Transfer Partners, says it will not endanger land or water, and it has appealed to the new Trump administration. Meanwhile, hundreds of veterans are about to join the protesters camping in the cold. A group called Veterans for Standing Rock wanted to enlist about 500 vets to act as human shields. They got more than 2,000, and hundreds of thousands of dollars have been pledged to support them. Dakota Blue Serna is among the former Marines heading to Standing Rock this weekend. He's with us from the studios of WMUK in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And Dakota, first, your name suggests you're Native American, but I understand you're not.
No, I'm actually Irish-Mexican. my father, he really was into the traditions and the cultures of the Native American, especially the Sioux. And that's where my name derived from, friend of the people and a warrior.
Well, yes, a vet. And so is that what's compelling you to go, your own identity? Why are you going to Standing Rock?
Well, I think a lot of veterans share my feelings that with these last couple wars in Iraq and Afghanistan that we got cheated. We were lied to from our government. And we went and we fought a war based on a lie. And so a lot of our guys are feeling that our service really was for nothing. And so now we're going out there because, you know, this is what we signed up for. This is where our passion is. This is what we signed up to defend, are the people here in our country against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Mm-hmm. And right now, you know, I love my government. I love my country. But the government's kind of cracking down on peaceful protesters. And it broke my heart to watch these people being sprayed with water in 25-degree temperatures. You know, that's inhumane, that's unethical, and that's un-American.
Well, and we want to underscore that. It was that image. You really don't know where you fall on the actual controversy over the pipeline.
Not really. I got friends on both sides. You know, I understand both sides of the story here, and that's it's a little bit unfortunate. You catch flack from both ends, but I've got brothers that got out of the military, became police officers, and some of them got in the oil industry. And I will say that the general consensus of those guys, they do agree with me when I say we need to find alternative sources of energy, and we have the means and the technology to do so, and we need to move away from sucking the Earth's lifeblood out of the ground, you know, and polluting our air. Yeah. And it's possible, and I don't understand why people are, you know, the people with the money and make those decisions are pushing away from that.
Well, so you've told us you're going to both protect, be a human shield for the civilians, but also do your own research, educate yourself, find out what you can about the issue. Look, as you well know, there have been some serious clashes there. Water cannons, as you said, sprayed on a crowd in freezing weather. A woman seriously injured. There's debate over how that happened. But what happens if security forces do move in on the civilians there? What are you prepared to do? I mean, could you possibly provoke more of a problem?
Me personally, I don't believe I would be provoking any problem. It's taken a lot from myself to make the decision to go to Standing Rock and be completely peaceful and nonviolent, no matter what happens. I know there's a lot of veterans out there that are not going because they can't watch American citizens being beat or their fellow veterans being beaten or shot with rubber bullets and remain peaceful. So hopefully, you know, this is a big group of veterans going, and we can keep it completely peaceful. And if the law enforcement decide they want to enforce and use force, then so be it. I'll take my lickings. You know, I've taken them before, but, you know, this isn't about me. This is about, you know, doing the right thing. And I really want the American people to understand. I know there's a bitterness that towards a veteran because we were used in such a horrible manner in the Iraq and Afghanistan war, but this is what we signed up for. If there's any danger presenting itself to the American people, we will put ourselves in between that danger.
So again, you're to be the human shield to take, as you say, the lickens so that the civilians don't. You're not about fighting back. I just want to mention, too, this isn't the first time you've felt a cause mobilize you. You've been an activist for medical marijuana because you use it to cope with PTSD.
Correct.
Yeah. What do you want people to know about that?
It's, you know, more and more people are waking up in the country. A lot of the people in the states that have medical marijuana are educated and are getting educated about it. So, you know, I want those people out there that don't necessarily have the means to use it to understand that it's not this horrible drug that the government made it out to be, but it's actually a very beautiful medicine that is saving lives and it's killing cancer. And it's keeping my veteran brothers and sisters from killing themselves. And so we're pushing for it to allow the government to allow us to use it the way we see fit.
Okay. A second issue there. Well, Dakota Blucerna is among the 2,000 Marines heading to Standing Rock this weekend to be human shields between civilians and possible security forces. Dakota Blucerna, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.